Hello, and welcome to this episode of Surety Today. Surety Today is a live monthly call-in podcast presented by the Surety and Fidelity Law Group at Wright, Constable & Skeen, located in the Mid-Atlantic region. Surety Today is offered to Surety Claims professionals and is designed to keep you informed about important issues in the industry. Here is your host, Michael Stover.
Well, welcome everyone to this edition of Surety Today. My name is Mike Stover, and I'm a partner in the Surety Fidelity Law Group at Wright, Constable & Skeen, serving the surety industry in the Mid-Atlantic region. As usual, we'd like to start our episodes with a thank you to all of our listeners and supporters of Surety Today, and remind everyone that you can listen to one or all of our prior 93 episodes now of Surety Today anytime, anywhere, from any one of our multiple platforms. Our Surety Today page on our website at wcslaw.com. As a podcast, it's Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple, Stitcher, Podbean. Just search for Surety Today, and you will find various platforms and methods to check out the prior episodes. As always, we've muted the line during the presentation to avoid any background noise, and we'll unmute the line at the end for any questions. Today, our topic is lessons learned in claims handling from a surety claims expert. And our special guest today is Richard Kowalczyk. Mr. Kowalczyk has extensive experience in the surety bond industry and is currently an independent consultant providing consulting services to sureties and contractors and financial institutions. He earned his Juris Doctorate degree from the University of Maryland in 1973 and was admitted to the Maryland Bar that same year. Rich practiced in private practice in Maryland for 13 years and has over 26 years of experience in the surety industry. He has worked as claims counsel, senior claims counsel, claims manager and or director of claims offices and or regions for some of the nation's largest surety companies, including Fireman's Fund Insurance Company, USF&G, Fidelity and Deposit Company of Maryland, and Zurich Surety Claims. Mr. Kowalczyk has extensive experience directly handling claims, supervising and training other claims handlers as well. While at F&D, he handled F&D's largest principal bankruptcy in the company's history, at that time arranging for completion of over $500 million in work and recovering over $120 million to the surety. He authored the takeover and completion chapter of the Bond Default Manual, second edition, for the ABA. So I've known Rich for many years and have retained his services as an expert witness on behalf of surety companies. And, you know, it occurred to me that an expert witness with extensive in-house experience and who's been involved in over 50, 60 cases as an expert witness would have some good insights and knowledge to share with the industry. And so this episode was planned. Without further ado, let's jump in. Rich, please give us a quick overview of what are typically the issues that you're seeing that are being questioned in the cases that you get involved with.
Well, Mike, when a claimant's handling claims handling is being questioned, the claimants who are questioning it generally look at four separate areas. And I separated these areas out, of course, just for logic and being able to deal with them. And we'll talk about each of them a little bit. But they are essentially the question as to whether there's a fair and independent investigation, whether there is a complete and timely investigation, the analysis that was performed and any conclusions reached as a result of that, and then finally, the course of action that was decided on.
Okay, so in your experience, what does it mean to conduct an independent investigation?
Well, as everyone knows in the industry, that term's been bandied about quite a bit, and it's been questioned. But essentially, an independent investigation means not looking at the facts or allegations with a jaundiced eye, not favoring one side over the other. Now, this doesn't mean believing everything a party has to state or a factual witness has to state, and the alleged facts should be verifiable, logical, and make sense to you. Be wary of critical judgments about the person or the allegation unless that fact is known to you as clearly false. So it often happens, we're human beings, and you listen to somebody's story, or that's the way they tell it, or their mannerisms, or whatever it is, their aggressiveness, and you may tend to make a negative inference from the way they're presenting it. All you're interested in is the facts themselves and just the facts. And I might say, oftentimes, claimants, whether they're owners, claimants, principals who are fighting an indemnity, well, not necessarily the principals, but the claimants and the owners, question whether the surety is obligated to hire independent, so-called independent experts to decide which side of the facts is correct. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But that's not a necessary part of an independent investigation. Doing what is normally done in the industry, as far as getting the facts alleged from each side of the claim, is all part of an investigation, period. These things, the favoring of one side over another, generally winds up being inferred from the language that's used, whether it's in correspondence, maybe some snide comments, some conclusions or something of that nature, or notes that may be in the file, and perhaps even from the familiarity with the party. So oftentimes you have an ongoing relationship with the principal, and one has to be a little careful, I believe, in how you write up what that principal is telling you so it doesn't seem like your buddy, the contractor, is believable and the other side isn't. That should be obvious to everybody, but it happens from time to time. The next thing, a point I would make about this independent investigation, and Mike and I talked a little bit about this the other day, be wary of allowing a principal or a claimant to draw you into a contentious back and forth. And contentious is the operative word here. Going back and forth and getting allegations or factual allegations from each side is a part of the claims handling. But don't let them draw you into a nasty name-calling and such as that kind of thing. And the obtaining of each side's position is certainly a part of your investigation. But there's a difference between obtaining a party's factual allegations and their characterizations of each other and the other's actions. So it goes without stating, but in an investigation, light is what you're after, not heat and not fire. And don't get drawn into the heat or the fire. The next point would be avoid judgmental opinions about people, facts, or allegations. Characterizing a person negatively does little to advance the investigation or analysis of the situation. And believe me, it happens from time to time. Again, we're all human, and some people really will rub you the wrong way. Some people, I think, glory in trying to rub you the wrong way to draw something out of you. And some claimants and even principals appear to use offensive characterizations as a tactic in trying to win a point or even just to provoke. Stay above the fray in such situations. Don't get drawn into it, even at the slightest in the way you word your letters, etc. Investigations necessarily, everybody knows, should be fact-based and fact-driven. This should be clear by now, as it's the common thread through all of this. All of the questioning that goes on is whether it was fact-driven and fact-based. Stick to the facts, and it reminds me of the old line from Sergeant Friday on the old Dragnet show, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. And that's all you really want. Thing. What's that, Mike?
I was thinking the same thing about that old
show. I was listening to it on old-time radio just the other day, by the way, and I heard the line. Investigation should be fact-based, okay? So you can't go wrong if what you're doing is accumulating facts, even if they're allegations of facts, and putting them down on paper. That just avoid anything else and you won't get into any kind of difficulty with your notes. And of course, it stands to reason. Don't jump to conclusions about allegations, people, or events. So, you know, you may draw, you eventually will jump to a conclusion or come to a conclusion in handling a file. But don't, quote, jump to conclusions. I saw a study the other day about how human beings are really good at creating, let's say, patterns in what they're looking at. And I think we do the same thing in claims handling, and we do the same thing in judging people. If they fall into a certain category, we tend to plug them in there, and they may not fit. So it gets you in trouble to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is a very, really important point that Rich is making. I know that when you get into situations that with bad faith is being alleged and all of that, and these internal communications start to come out, even from consultants, and you see derogatory terms and things like that, and that's just really, really difficult to deal with when the bad faith allegations are out there. Rich and I had one of the cases I had Rich on as an expert was a bad faith case. We were able to beat that back and get summary judgment. But Rich, do you have any suggestions as to how the claims handler can, you know, ensure that they're conducting this independent investigation?
Mike, a thought had occurred to me some time ago in doing this work that I would have liked to have thought this way more logically as I was handling claims myself. And that is, you know, we approach these claims and you're busy, you're trying to get to a conclusion of the thing, you're trying to figure out what to do next. And we tend to jump around, so to speak, in our mind. So we go look at the job site, talk to the consultant, talk to the owner, and right away we're jumping to some kind of conclusions about what we're looking at, what we might be able to do in this, et cetera, et cetera. And in order to keep the file clean, so to speak, and our thinking and process clean, I would suggest to try to compartmentalize these things. So in your mind or in your file even, have an investigation then leading to factual conclusions and, of course, eventually your course of action, and separate the three, so to speak. Now, that may seem a little dumb, but believe me, when you're jumping around, you tend to jump around in your thinking processes too. So if you can compartmentalize it and put these things into categories, it'll be easier to stick to the facts. We all know and say that sureties do not have to be and should not be the, quote, judge and jury. And everyone knows that we as human beings don't always act that way. And we get pushed all the time in claims to come to a conclusion. There's a time in the course of a claim when the claim handler has to decide whether the claim's contested and perhaps even whether there is a genuine dispute. One does not have to act as a judge or jury to decide this issue. So it's certainly everyone knows what a genuine dispute is. And as long as it's factually based or it's based on the law or based on an interpretation of contract, then that's fair game for litigation. And the independent arbiters, whether it's an arbitration panel or a judge or a jury, are to decide those issues. As a surety, you don't have to, and that's what we mean by not being a judge and a jury. This point in time, it seems to me, requires a lower threshold than a decision by a judge or a jury would require. So even though you're making a decision about the facts you have, it's a lower threshold, and all you're really deciding is whether there is a valid dispute, not one based on a witness somebody just found in the closet, but a valid dispute. And so when you make that decision, it seems to me it's separate from and different than a decision on the course of action to claim of the claim, how to handle it as a business decision. So certainly you can have claims that are business proper disputes. They are contested claims. And yet you then have to figure, what should I do with this thing? So, of course, you know the next steps. You decide, whether to deny the claim, whether to try to work something out, et cetera, et cetera. But again, if you compartmentalize these things, you have your facts there. Now you've decided whether it's a disputed fact situation or not, and then you move forward to the next thing, and that would be the analysis. So we say that each claim is unique because of the variances in contracts, bond forms, projects, all kinds of variances, sections of the country. But be aware of falling into repetitive traps, doing what one usually does. I've heard it said in my career about one or two people, they may have had 25 years experience, but it was really just a couple years of experience doing the same thing over and over again. Now, I know most of us don't fall into that, but it was just the point being made was the person handled the same claim, a claim, the same way his entire career, did the same thing all the time. It may work a lot of times, and sometimes it will not. And so I mentioned the article about us as human beings being able to distill from situations and wind up with types or patterns in our minds. Avoid the mental shortcuts when you're handling this, such as, oh, it's this type of project, or this type of bond, or this type of claim, and then automatically run with it the way you've run with all of, quote, those types of claims, those types of bonds, those types of projects in the past. We have to take a little breather, I think, and when you're doing your analysis, look for the nuanced differences in claims. And I could list a number of things, but just to make the point, there might be an urgency to some projects to move quickly, more quickly than we usually move. There may be additional language in the bond form, so it may seem very similar to ones you've handled before, but there may be another clause in there that can change whatever the ultimate decision is. Different clauses in the contract, different clauses on termination, on cure, and certainly on the type of work, et cetera. And again, you could have differences in damages, for example. And I mentioned some of the other clauses. And all of these things are important. Don't just treat them as all the same because the language may be similar. It may be similar, but it is not the same. And that can get you into some difficulties.
Okay, good advice there. And I think this, you were talking about compartmentalizing and having, the various phases of your investigation sort of, spelled out in separate sections. That plays into this next issue that I want to talk about, and that's, when you get involved as an expert witness, one of the things that you need to see, right off the bat is the claim file. So, in your experience, what are you finding in these claim files these days, as you've gone paperless and people working remotely and all of that?
Mike, that's a good question, and in fact, that's the first thing somebody I will say to somebody when they contact me, and I'd say, well, I've got to take a look at the claim file. That's your documentation. And unfortunately, I found these days oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, claim files do not have much in them, whether they're electronic files or whether they're still paper files or combinations. Oftentimes these days, there's just the correspondence between the parties. So there's little or no information concerning the course of the investigation, the purpose, and the results, other than the back and forth that may be in correspondence. And I believe, I think this is true, and I believe this arises from the fear of claim handlers and of companies that if you put it in writing, it can always be misinterpreted or thrown back in your face or something like that in the future. I honestly and earnestly believe, Mike, that one can safely document a file with a contemporaneous record of the facts that you've established, the attempts that you've made to establish those facts. Sometimes you can't establish the facts, and any conclusion you reach in the course of action. So again, if you record these notes at least to that effect in the file, keep them clean of characterizations, of stereotypes, of of comments about people, et cetera, and keep it to just the facts. I really don't find, one, a problem with doing that and documenting the file, and two, believe me, clear communication goes a long way to the proper handling of these things. And it's got to be clear, concise communication. And I guess, you know, it's easy for me to say since I'm not actually handling claims anymore, and I can hear some people saying that to themselves. But I think this is not a whole lot to ask. It's, I think that if you do that, you keep yourself clean. You compartmentalize that file, state what the investigation is, the steps you've taken, et cetera, as we went over before. And if you have just the notes documenting those in the file, I think you're well on your way to avoiding any kind of difficulties. So, you know, the other point, and I know we talked about this the other day, Mike, is that litigation is often delayed, extended in time. I mean, I have several matters that have gone on for years and years. One piece of litigation lasted for 7 years. And when that happens, there are occasions when claim handlers are gone, files change hands, even during the actual handling of the claim itself. So the actual contemporaneous thought processes that were reached in the investigation, in the analysis, the setting of the course of an action, all that can be lost. Someone may contact you years later, and you'd be lucky to barely recall the main facts of the file. So in that kind of situation, can you credibly establish what occurred, what investigation, the details of the investigation, what the analysis was, why the course of action was chosen that it was, without much documentation? It gets really, really difficult to do that. And when it's documented and you're following the steps you all know that one has to follow, I don't think there should be much of a problem, to be honest with you. People may disagree with the conclusion you reach, but there shouldn't be a problem. One thing that, again, I think along with the documentation a little bit is talking about the use of outside vendors. No matter whether that's the engineering consultants, construction consultants, or even legal representation, et cetera, you know, I think it would be a good idea to do what I know a lot of companies really require of their claims handlers anyway, and that is documentation to set out the scope of what you're doing. So, you know, you want them to investigate a claim, it would include a site visit, no site visit, reviewing documentation, et cetera, et cetera. Same with the legal. And I know that it's darn near impossible at the beginning of a claim to think of anything, I mean everything that's going to happen and what needs to be documented. But you can outline it and you can supplement it briefly as you're going along. This gives a justification for the expenditure, which we know oftentimes, especially in indemnity actions, et cetera, but also in other types of claims and actual litigation, winds up being questioned. And so, you know, you shouldn't have a problem justifying it if you show proper reason for use of the vendors, and then secondly, an attempt to monitor those costs. So I think that's about it for the time, and I think I've just about said everything I need to, or I can say about this stuff, Mike. Any thoughts, questions?
We're at the end of our time, and I feel like there's a lot more we could talk about. Maybe we'll have to set up another round two of this and go into some stories and some other things. But I you know, what you're saying about maintaining the files and keeping accurate records and all that is very important, particularly when somebody is claiming bad faith. I mean, it's going to be very helpful to show contemporaneously what was going on in the process that you were following and recommendations that you received and all of that.
Exactly. You never stumble when you cite the facts. That's what I firmly believe.
and I, you know, that whole issue of getting drawn into, I think even the outside counsel will fall victim to that, and, you know, fighting with opposing counsel or that kind of thing. I think it's important, though, what you're not saying is that, you know, you don't respond. You do respond, but you respond, you know, calmly and logically and respond to their allegations factually and with the law. And not get into these heated exchanges. That's all great advice. Hard to do, you know, like you say, we're human, we got emotions.
But it gets difficult sometimes, but it's critical to stay above the fray.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, I appreciate all your insights and coming on with us. So just to close out before we open up for any questions. So the next episode will be on Monday, May 13th. Of course, at 12:30. The upcoming event, April 17th, the Philadelphia Surety Claims Association is holding its lunch meeting, and they're going to offer ethics credits, CLE, CE credits. The topic will be how the attorney and the expert work together. The 35th Annual Southern Surety and Fidelity Claims Conference will be held April 24th through the 26th in Clearwater, Florida. If you did not get an invite to that, let me know or contact anyone at ForCon, and we can get you one. I'll be attending that and hope to see everyone there for some fun in the sun. On May 23rd through the 24th, the ABA FSLC will hold its annual spring meeting. This year, it's going to be held in La Jolla, California. June 3rd is the Philadelphia Surety Claims annual golf outing at the Bala Country Club in Philadelphia. That's always a good, fun event. June 19th through the 21st, you've got the Surety Claims Institute holding its annual meeting this year in Colorado Springs, Colorado. So you can go to our Surety Today blog website at wcslaw.com, and you can see the calendar of all the surety events that we're aware of. Thanks again to Rich and for everyone. All right, so we've opened up the line. If you have any questions for Rich, now's the time. Any questions, anybody? All right, well, again, thank you, Rich, and thank you, everyone, for calling in. Talk to you, everybody, next month.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Surety Today. Audio recordings and white papers from prior episodes are available on the Surety Today page of the Wright, Constable & Skeen website at wcslaw.com/surety-today.